I'm realizing in my as I get older that you don't fool anybody. I think I spent most of my life thinking I was fooling everybody, and thinking I had everything figured out. And I don't think we fool anybody. I preach some at the church, not regularly though. Frank's not in the room. You see, you're not supposed to preach regularly until you get through the Presbyterian. I don't preach. Oh, well, there's Frank. Thanks. I don't preach regularly, just sometimes. Infrequently. Irregularly, I preach. He's a senior pastor. He does all those sort of things. And we were teaching on the promises of God, and he gave me the promise that God promises rest. And so he gave me the passage in Matthew, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. And so it's Saturday evening. I have not finished my sermon on rest, and I decided it'd be a good idea just to run over to the church, and I could print some things up. My computer would be there. I'd do a better job. Now, I remembered when I first came on at Christ Covenant that they did say something about the security system. But, you know, there's so much stuff you're learning when you first start a job. You don't, you know, and I'm never going to steal anything from the church, so I figure I don't need to know much about the security system. So now that you have that background, let's go back to the story. At 10 o'clock or so, I go over to the church, and I start working on the sermon on rest, and it's now about 1 a.m. I finish the sermon, I think. All right, I'll be very well equipped to teach on rest tomorrow at 1 a.m. as I finish my sermon. And so I hit the button to print, and the printer is in another room. And as I got up out of my chair and went into the hallway, that's where the sensors are for the security alarm that comes on at 11 o'clock, which I didn't know. I do know now. And so all of a sudden now the alarm's going off, and it automatically calls the deacons. It has a phone tree, a phone tree on the system, so that it begins to call. If there's an emergency in the building, it'll call the deacon. It'll let it ring so many times. If there's not an answer, it goes to the next one. Well, now it's 1 in the morning, and the deacons are being awakened one by one. And so I'm trying to think. Well, if I just hurry, I can rush out the door. And by the time anybody gets here, they'll just wonder what happened. And so I was getting all my. That's really what I was going to do. And so I was getting all my stuff together, and Knox County Sheriff's at the door, and so now it's like the alarm is still going off. I've got the sheriff at the door. Deacons are now calling the church, and so it was just a great morning to be reminded that I was the expert to talk about rest. I think there's some parallel there. What you're going to find, and we're going to look in Ezekiel in just a moment, that ultimately when God chastises and he uses the word shepherds, the leaders of Israel, he says they did such a bad job, he's going to take over. And the truth is, you're really not shepherds. You're kind of junior shepherds. And the chief shepherd, it doesn't mean what you're doing doesn't matter. It just means that he's not going to let his children go. But he has given you a beautiful part in the journey. It's really hard to say, how do you describe this? How do you describe the reality that what you're doing is important, but God isn't broken down needing your help? How do you speak both of those things to be true? I'll tell you just a quick story about that, and then we'll look at Ezekiel together. We've just got a long way to go this morning and with a lot of material to talk about. I told you yesterday I wasn't very handy. We had a broken doorknob at our house, and I decided how hard could that be? And what would it take you probably an hour to do? On a good day, it would take me probably 2 hours to do. But Skyler decided he wanted to help. And so what would have been a one-hour job for most of you becomes a two-hour job for me, becomes an entire morning. And he's got a plastic hammer, and he's hitting the door. And at one point, he grabs the two screws that hold in the thing, and he runs through the house with them. I said, we need those back. It was so convoluted that it was one of those pistol things, you know, and I put it in and it twisted wrong, so I had to take the whole thing off, put it back together. And when we get it, so this job now is an entire morning, but we finally get that we take it back out, we reinstall it, we have the doorknob working, and Mona comes home, and Skyler sticks out his chest. He says, "Look what I did. I fixed the door." Now, the truth is, I could have done it better without him. But he needed to be about his father's business, because that's what gave him purpose in life, and it allowed him to be about something that mattered in the kingdom of our world. Remember when the Pharisees said to Jesus, "Get these people to shut up." He said, "I could get the rocks to sing my praises." Jesus doesn't need you to shepherd. He's invited you to shepherd, because if you don't, you won't sacrifice like you're supposed to. If you don't, you won't look like Jesus as you grow up. If you don't, you'll just live a life that doesn't matter. You'll just collect things. So he says, the shepherds of Israel, they really messed up. We'll look at that in a minute in Ezekiel 34 together. He said, "I'm going to take care of my sheep." But then he invites you to shepherd with him, because you need to be about your father's business. It's important. It's crucial. It matters. And he will take care of his sheep. You've got to hold both those truths in tension. Let's look together for just a moment. Last night, I tried to talk about what we saw in Ezekiel. We talked about leaders. And if anything I would say about that the moments we spent in Scripture last night, I would say that it reminded you of the depth of what it means to lead. That you're not supposed to just whitewash things over, put Jesus syrup on it, tell them everything's going to be okay. When there's a breach in the wall, you're not supposed to just put pretend on top of it. Jesus did not die on the cross so we could pretend. And so he asked us to take seriously the breaches in the wall. So if I were to say what I wanted us to get out of the beginning of our time together last night was notice the depth of leading and shepherding. Today, from the same book, a little bit later, still complaining about the way God is still talking about how the leaders have failed them, he talks about shepherds. And what I want you to catch in this is the breadth of shepherding. Last night, I wanted you to catch the depth. But I want you to see the breadth of shepherding. So I'm going to read at the NIV, chapter 34, the book of Ezekiel, and it says this: "The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesying against the shepherds of Israel. The prophecy, and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says." I think we ought to listen. "Woe to the shepherds of Israel who take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with wool, slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You've not strengthened..." Listen to the breath of what he's expecting a shepherd to do. Feel the invitation, not the weight. The weight's on God's shoulders. But feel the invitation of the breath of what he's inviting you to do in other people's lives. Because here's his complaint against those shepherds: "You've not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You've not brought back the strays and searched for the lost. You've ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered because there were no shepherd. And they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered all over the mountains and on every high hill, and they were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. And that's when he then shifts the tone and begins to say, I'm going to take care of it, but what I want you to hear is the weight of that. Do you hear that? We could have spent the entire weekend, and I actually thought about using this passage as kind of the whole weekend, just to talk about what each of those things might mean, and that would be a great way for you to spend some time on your own just studying. But a couple of things I just want you to notice. Notice the sacrifice. You don't sacrifice because it works. You sacrifice because if you sacrifice, you'll be more like Jesus. You see, to the level that you sacrifice, if Christ doesn't intervene, you'll start to feel entitled. That's why Christ needs to intervene, or your sacrifice becomes self-righteousness. When we first moved to Knoxville, I became a pastor there, and somebody gave us season passes to Dollywood. Now, you're close enough to Knoxville to know about Dollywood. It's kind of an odd thing to explain to people outside of this area. It's kind of like if Mickey Mouse married a stripper, and then they had a child who became born again. And then that born again child opened up an amusement park in the middle of the mountains and liked country music. You've got Dollywood. You understand that. Most people around the world, when you just say, I got tickets to Dollywood, have no idea. So I'm giving these tickets to Dollywood. They're season passes for my wife, my son, and myself. And they expired in January. And you know what I thought? Who's going to give me tickets next year? Do you know what that is? That's entitlement. It's idolatrous. It's a sense that I didn't sacrifice for the sake of the gospel. I sacrificed for what I could get. That's not sacrifice. That's training. That's trading. The sense of entitlement that comes over us, you've got to be careful of that. There's two things that you're going to see happen to you if you really take shepherding seriously. First, you're going to have to fight this natural human tendency to feel entitled, like you deserve something because you've sacrificed something. You're going to have to fight that because that's as common as the rain. It's the way that it's Christ has to intervene. Second thing that's going to happen to many of you is someone that you are shepherding will betray you. The human heart wasn't made for betrayal. I mean, that's the oldest trick in Satan's book. What he does is he has somebody that you're called to betray you, and then you begin to resent the people you're called to help. So God gives you a call to help the homeless, and a homeless guy steals something out of your car. You try to help a family. You go and visit them a lot in the hospital, and all of a sudden they decide not to come back to church anymore, and you start to resent the fact of doing that. I guarantee you that you will fight those two battles as shepherds. A battle of entitlement. I've sacrificed. I deserve. Oh, and that goes at the very core of self-righteousness, and God wants to really, he does call you to sacrifice, but again, for him, not for yourself. And then the second thing that you're going to have to fight is a sense of betrayal that will come when someone that is on your list, somebody on your sheet of paper that says, you're supposed to shepherd these people. Somebody on that list is going to betray you. And when they do, you'll be tempted to become cynical. As I get older, the battle with me is between cynicism and vulnerability. I think as you get older, you can either become more cynical or more vulnerable. And vulnerability is not the natural direction that we take. And so what happens is somebody that I serve betrays me. And it might be just a betrayal of they don't thank you, they don't call you back, Or they go to another church because they liked the music better. Or they tell somebody that you didn't do a good job. Or they go somewhere else and they speak poorly of you. Oh, that's the moment where the human heart feels betrayal. There's a reason that betrayal is woven into God's narrative of his, of the gospel, is because he knows that betrayal would have been one of the most difficult things for the human heart to deal with, so he put it into his story so that we would know he knows. So those are two things that you're gonna wrestle with. The reason that and please, here's an assumption that you need to be aware of. We're going to get back to the passage. I know I just did a little bit of a rabbit trail, but just stay with me for just a second if you would. People are ambivalent. People want to get better, and they don't want to get better. They want to be shepherded, and they want to be left alone. And people are ambivalent, and if you're not aware of that, you're going to, I think I went into counseling initially because I wanted people to like me. That sure has worked out really well. because I thought that people would be so glad that I was there to help them. Instead, many people just kind of resent the fact they needed help. And then when there's things I can't really help, I can't really fix things, because people aren't mechanical beings that need to be fixed. They're relational beings with things that need to be faced. And since I can't fix them, we're not a car that needs a tune-up. We're an image bearer of God that needs to have to face soulishly important things. And so when they come to me and I try to, they want to be fixed, I can't fix them. I found that they were sometimes disappointed with me, and I thought, oh no, maybe I should become a pastor. Well, that's not worked out either. You need to understand that people are ambivalent. You know, when Jesus walks up to the man at the pool of Bethesda, that's not a cruel question when he says, do you want to be well? What a story, by the way. Jesus could have gone anywhere he wanted to before the festival. He chose to go to the place where everybody was suffering. That's where Jesus shows up. That's where he shows up on a Sunday morning before he goes to the synagogue, before the festival, and he shows up at the pool of Bethesda. But then he does something incredibly odd. He steps over people, and he's obviously there because he cares. He could have gone anywhere. He's concerned with their suffering. But he picks a 38-year-old man, probably the least that we would have picked. We'd have picked one of the kids. And he comes up to him, and he ends up healing him. But he asks a question that really speaks to the very essence of the ambivalence we all feel about change. Do you want to be well? You want to be well? Yeah, I want to be well, but I don't know that I want to pay the price to be well. So the first thing would be the idea of, do you want to be well? Back to the passage. It says this. The first thing I would want you to notice is notice the sacrifice. These people, one of the criticisms of the Pharisees was that they did not use their resources for the other. They used their resources for themselves, so they didn't sacrifice. I'm just saying that the criticism was they took care of themselves at the expense of their sheep. They didn't sacrifice their own resources for their sheep. And that's their first criticism. Not only do I want you to notice the sacrifice, notice the significant list beyond just spiritual things. You've not strengthened the weak. You know what we tend to do? We tend to hang around with the strong. That's what I tend to do. I've noticed that. What people sometimes do when Skyler's around. They'll be nice to him initially, but they don't want to really, I understand that. But listen to what he says. He says that the shepherds, one of their problems is not only did they just take care of themselves and not use their resources for the other, but you have not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bound up the injured. Those are physical needs. You're not going to shepherd. Be real careful that you don't turn shepherding into, are they using the right version of the Bible? And, you know, did they understand, did they show up at church on Sunday? We do an odd thing in our culture about spirituality. We separate spirituality from everything else. And it really is just a way to keep us from really doing really good work in somebody's life. In reality, you don't separate those things. And often when they need something spiritual, it's because something physical is not working. I'm feeling weak. I'm sick. I don't understand why my kids are sick. By the way, just to get you to worry, you know there's 4 inches of snow and all of your children are with babysitters locked inside their home right now. Just want to encourage you. Just want to encourage you. Beautiful home is being destroyed right at this moment as your children are running amok with a 17-year-old who's working for minimum wage. I'm just saying. I'm just saying you ought to be aware of what is true. We don't separate the physical from the spiritual. As a matter of fact, one thing you need to do if you're going to be a good shepherd is you need to understand that a lot of times people ask spiritual questions. They're really asking emotional, psychological, and other sort of questions. You remember the story of the church where the young man, a true story in California, went to his youth pastor and said, "Do people go to hell if they commit suicide?" And the youth pastor thought he was just asking a theological question, so he answered it theologically. He talked about the assurance of salvation, and he said, "Now, I think somebody who really knows Jesus wouldn't be considering suicide. However, no, you would not lose your salvation if you were to kill yourself." He went home and he killed himself. Parents sued the church. The parents won because the court said that the youth group leader failed to warn. Now, what really happened is a youth group leader failed to understand that to be a shepherd is not to just care about, do you use the new ESV or the new, or are you going to stick with an older something? I mean, that spiritual questions are not the only questions. The end of the day is all questions are ultimately spiritual because we are spiritual beings. We are spiritual beings. But do you see how the criticism of these shepherds, it said, you didn't, and then it lists physical things they didn't do. Did you seek the weak and help them? Think about when you look over your group, don't just think about who's the best leader. One of the problems with one of the reasons the Christian, kind of a Christian evangelism is not working with a generation below us, or probably two generations below me, is that my generation, the church decided that the way to do evangelism in my generation was win with the winners, go with the goers, be with the beers. And so we said, we're going to get the captain of the football team to follow Jesus. Look what else is going to happen. The church as a whole and a lot of parachurch organizations kind of fell into that, and there's nothing evil in that. You know, when you see Jesus building his ministry, he did take one person like that. He did take a Paul, who was kind of a, but mostly he took the least of these. And I think what happened is this generation came up and said, so is the gospel just for the cheerleaders and the captains of the football team? But no wonder they're saying everything's great. They know Jesus because they get all the stuff I don't have. And there was a cynicism that started to build. And it's because I don't think we focused on the strengthening of the weak. We focused on finding the strong to put them on our team. And so, shepherds, when you look over your list, don't just go, well, they'd be a good leader. They'd be a good, I think they'd be a good deacon. Well, I think they'd be a good elder. That's great. Do a little of that. But also ask the question, according to the text, who's the weakest? Who needs to be bound up? Next thing, notice the searching that takes place. You've not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bound the injured. And now listen to this. I love this. This is just so beautiful. Listen to these words. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You've not brought back the strays. When I was reading this, thinking about our time together, I was thinking of all the people I know that have walked away. That I had some influence in their life. I really think this is a description of our generation right now. And I know I've been in those seminars with church growth and how do we reach millennials. And I think what we really did is we quit taking care of them the way shepherds were supposed to take care of them. And since we didn't take care of them that way, they were scattered. That's what it says happens to them. They get scattered in their food for wild animals. So the text says there's something about shepherds that have an eye to the people that are lost, that have an eye toward that person who's struggling, has an eye for the person who didn't show up and makes a call and says, hey, how you doing? Someone who seeks, looks for the lost, brings them back. Boy, what a great ministry to think of as a shepherd. When Jesus tells the parable of the shepherd and he talks about the sheep that was the shepherd that left the 99 and went for the one, the reason that's important is at some point in life, everybody's the one. And how you treat the one matters, because I'm going to be the one sometime. And when I'm the one and Jesus is the shepherd in that story, not you and I. And Jesus goes out and finds me lost and leaves the 99. But people will pay attention on what you do with the one. Did you go look for the lost? Did you restore them? Because if you don't, they'll wonder, what are you going to do with it? It's me. So there's a beautiful picture there of a searching. Well, we could spend, there's so many better theologians in this room than me, we could spend hours in this text. It's so rich, and there's so many layers of it. But I just wanted to use it this morning and be faithful to this text, but to use it as a way to introduce us to this idea of shepherding, the breadth of shepherding. What's all involved with not just the depth of it, but the breadth of it. The invitation for God to be about his kingdom's work. Oh, what a beautiful passage. Then it talks about what happens when you have sheep without shepherds. My sheep wandered all over the mountains, on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. And they became food for wild animals. And they were scattered. I do want you to notice one section I left out, a verse I left out, because I think that's what I'd like to kind of spend the last part of this talk on. Remember when Brian asked me to think with you about shepherding, I said you need to be curious. Tried to talk about that yesterday. You need to be humble. And you need to love stories. Into verse 4, you have not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bound the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost, for you've ruled them harshly and brutally. Reminds me in Galatians 6, where it says, brothers, if someone's caught in sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently, humbly. But watch yourself, so you also will be tempted. Carry each other's burdens. That way you fulfill Christ. Humility has to be a part of your shepherding. A couple of reasons I want you to think about that. First, look at the in Galatians where it says, lest you be tempted. It seems that you need to understand that we're all capable of falling in sin. We're all capable of being lost. We're all capable of losing perspective. And so you need to be humble. So the first reason I think you have to be humble when you're going to be a shepherd is you've got to realize that you too are a sinner, saved by God's grace and his gracious hand. And if it wasn't for that, who knows where you would be? And also knowing that you too could fall, you too could stumble. I know people that I would never have thought would have stumbled and fallen and crashed who have. And ironically, I know a few people I would have bet were going to fall in a second who seem to have stumbled into faithfulness. It's an interesting world we live in. Missionaries' kids sometimes become drug addicts, and drug addicts' kids become missionaries. I don't get it. But the first thing I would tell you is you need to be humble, because God says you have to be humble or restore people gently, shepherd gently, lest you also fall. The second reason I think you need to be humble is you need to understand that we're all, there's a reason people behave the way they do. The fancy way to say that is to say that we're teleological beings. Just call your children who are now running through your home and they won't ask what you're doing, but tell them you're doing really well, and then just say, oh, by the way, we just had a seminar. I learned we were teleological beings. Have a great day. And then just hang up on them. It'll be great. Teleological beings, it means that a person, it's moving a direction. There's a reason we do what we do. We are created in the image of a purposeful God. And since we're created in the image of a purposeful God, that means our behavior is purposeful even when we don't know it. If there's something you can't do that you say you want to do, it's because there's a more important goal you're meeting underneath the waterline. Like, I'd like to be in good physical shape. Now, most of you think that I am just by looking up here. And a lot of you are probably commenting on the fact that you think I'm probably an elite athlete. But no, looks deceive you. I could do a seminar on how to lose weight. I could do a seminar on how to exercise. I know all that stuff. And I'll always make goals. You know, I think I'm going to. But a long-term abstract goal, like I'd like to be in better shape, is always trumped by a short-term concrete goal of I'd like to feel better now. And when I see a plate of wings in front of me, there is an immediate concrete goal sitting right there that says you'll feel better fast if you eat those wings. And they are good. I mean, I'm not sure what heaven's going to be like, but I think there's going to be just tubs of buffalo sauce. I mean, can you imagine for eternity just laying in a tub of buffalo sauce? Just kind of pulling your head up every once in a while and put a little blue cheese in, and then. I mean, you think about heaven the way you want to. I've got my plans right there. But do you understand? We're teleological beings. There's a reason we do what we do. Even stuff that doesn't seem to make sense to you, like eating disorders or some of those behaviors that seem odd, if you'll look and if you know and if you're curious, if you're humble, and you try to stay into the story long enough, you'll find that there's a reason we do what we do. Because we're created in the image of a purposeful God, and therefore Our behavior is moving us in a direction, in a purpose. There's a reason we do what we do. And that's why you need to be humble. You need to be humble because just because there's a reason doesn't make it's okay. It's not a justification. Just because there's a reason, it doesn't mean that it's excused. It just means that it's understood. We're teleological beings, so you need to be humble. Because you probably don't know the whole story of why they struggle with what they struggle with. You don't know their story. You don't know what's happened to them in their lives. But as a shepherd, you ought to. We'll talk about story later on today, but I want you to like to buy a vowel. Do we have an interpreter for that? there's a reason we do what we do. So I can be humble as I deal with people. I learn their stories. Because, that doesn't give them an excuse, but it does help you understand. And as you understand, you can come alongside in a way that makes sense. So often, one of my biggest criticisms about Christian counseling and any kind of counseling is our focus on fruit instead of roots and shoots. So focus on the behavior, when the behavior is often the symptom of what's going on inside their heart. And no one's dealing with the issue of their heart, they're just dealing with the behavior. And I think as you are going to be a good shepherd, you're going to try to deal with not just the behavior that you see, but the energy beneath the behavior, the energy in their heart, their longing for purpose, and their longing for love, their longing for. So many of the bad things we do are tied to some of the best deep longings in us. And sometimes if you don't stop long enough to figure that out, you won't be a very good shepherd. And so when when the prophet is speaking for God to chastise the shepherds of Israel, he says that they ruled them brutally, harshly. That would be the opposite of shepherding with humility. There was a professor at RTS. I gave up 25 IQ points in every faculty meeting. Those guys were some of the smartest people. And they would always just kind of look at me when I'd ask questions like, give them a coloring book and we'll just be okay. We were hiring a new president, and so all the professors were supposed to come together and ask a question. All of them were asking questions about Ezekiel and Isaiah's or one or two, and what's your position on this and your position on that. And they got to me, and I thought, gosh, I don't even understand some of the questions they're asking. And so I just said, are you a lumper or a splitter? And the room just kind of went, please forgive us for our colleague who doesn't know. And I said, and so when I realized that no one in the room understood my question, I thought, well, I'm the smart one now. And I said, it just seems to me that in theology, people are either splitters, splitting things up and seeing how everybody's different from everybody else, or they're lumpers, putting things together. And I was just wondering if you basically consider yourself a lumper or a splitter. And he told me, and I don't think they ever invited me to come back to a faculty meeting about how to pick somebody. But there was a professor there by the name of Bruce Waalke. Bruce Waalke is probably one of the smartest human beings I've ever seen in my life. And what's funny about a scholar is a scholar doesn't make you feel stupid. A scholar makes you want to know more about whatever that person knows. Every time I heard Bruce Waugi speak, I would say, my life has been a waste. I'm going to quit my job and go study Hebrew the rest of my life. I mean, he was just so brilliant, but he was so kind in his brilliance. It was actually enjoyable instead of kind of like, you know, do you know what I mean? I think a real scholar puts stuff in low-hanging trees for the rest of us and doesn't make us feel stupid, makes us curious. And I always felt that around him. And so one day, Bruce Waugi walked up to me, and he says, Jim, I'd like to eat lunch with you sometime. I've got some things I want to talk to you about. I thought, oh, no. Mr. Psychologist who shouldn't be in a seminary, he's heard something I've said. I'm going to be taken to the woodshed by Bruce Waugi. And then I thought, it's okay. If you're going to go to the woodshed, let it be Bruce Waugi. I mean, if you don't know that name, there's not a theologian, both liberal or conservative, that doesn't know that name. Old Testament theologian is just absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. So we go out to eat. We're eating lunch together. And we're sitting there, and he says, you know, small talk at first. And the whole time, I'm just sweating, going, okay. Just, you know, dump the truck. Here it comes. I know I'm going to get it. And then about halfway through, he says, well, Jim. And I said, okay. I have such respect for this man. He's so much smarter than me. He's been around longer. I know he'll be right. Whatever he's going to tell me that I've said that was inaccurate, I'm not going to argue with Bruce Waugi about anything theological. And he goes, well, Jim, the reason I brought you here, and then he quoted something out of Leviticus. I didn't even know the reference, and I was, Leviticus? And then he said, I've watched the way you deal with people, and I was just wondering, is there anything you see in my life you think I need to change? You could have knocked me over. Because the smartest man I knew was being humble. I'll never forget that moment. I will never forget sitting in that Chinese restaurant, Orlando, Florida, off Red Bug Lake Road, fourth booth down, looking at Bruce Waugi and him saying to me, is there something you think I need to work on? That's a shepherd. Because it's humble. It's humble. It says I got a long way to go. And I still need things I need to learn. Don't just be struck by the depth that God is inviting you to be as a shepherd that doesn't whitewash things. Be struck by the breadth of it. The wide breadth of the privilege of walking in someone's life in a way that will deal with their personal life and their financial life and their physical life. You get to sacrifice for the sake of the gospel in their lives. The breadth of that. But always do it humbly, lest you also fall. Because that's how they need to be shepherded, by a humble yet strong shepherd. Let's pray together.